Good evening. Welcome to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Enter freely and of your own will. In this episode, you may find many strange things, for the films to be discussed are old, and they have many memories. So, beware. Beware.
Hey, greetings, guys. Welcome to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. As always, from Boston, this is Scott.
This is Jim Towns from LA.
And thanks so much for hopping on with us. And it'd been a little while for Jim. Sometimes life happens and we get busy. It's been probably too long, Jim, since we sat down and recorded. And I'm hoping we didn't pick up any bad habits in the last, probably it's been almost a month, I'd say, right?
I hope I didn't forget how to talk. I don't think I did. I practice quite often.
I feel like we had such a great cadence going on, and then, you know, life happens, and but we're back better than ever. And Jim had a great idea. It's like, you know, it's been a long time since we recorded. We got to come out with a bang. And, you know, we're going to throw around a couple of different ideas. I mean, all great films, but he's like, you know what? Let's just come out of the gate with The Wolfman. It's like, hell yes. Hell yes. I don't know. The Mount Rushmore of Universal films for me. I mean, Wolfman is up there. I mean, I don't know.
Oh yeah, it's the third axis of the Great Triangle, isn't it? Right?
It feels that way. Yeah, I'm always like, it's, you know, what's my top three, top five? I think this is definitely top three for me. I mean, Bride's up there. Wolfman, absolutely. And it's like the third one. I don't know. It's, I mean, sometimes it's Invisible Man. I mean, I go back, like, I mean, I love Black Cat. There's so many great ones. But yeah, Wolfman for me, this is the tippy top of the mountaintop for me.
It's an important one for me as well. So I'm really anxious to get into this.
Cool. So let's do it. As everyone probably knows out of listening to the horror podcast or a horror podcast, have probably seen this one before, but regardless, we're going to go through the players. So, of course, Lon Chaney Jr. as Lawrence Talbert / the Wolfman, Claude Rains as his dad, Sir John Talbert, Ralph Bellamy as Captain Paul Montford, the awesome, incredible Maria Osmanskaya, who we'll see in a couple of films as Maliva, Evelyn Akers as Gwen Cotliff, Patrick Knowles as her fiance's love interest, Frank Andrews. Got to mention, of course, Bela Lugosi as Bella, of course.
Is the creatively named Bella.
Yeah, why not? I mean, he looks like a Bella. It's such a great name, so might as well keep him Bella and easy to remember on the set. And then, of course, Mr. Jack Pierce, makeup artist man himself. So,
if Frankenstein is his Mona Lisa, this is his Last Supper, maybe. You know? I mean, this is really like the other one that just... I know I always talk about prototypes, but we'll get into the details of it and stuff like that. But yeah, a big one.
It's a huge one. And yeah, we can get into the makeup a little bit, you know, at least with Jack Pierce, but, you know, of course, covering Werewolf of London, you know, this makeup deal and, you know, Jim, you could certainly get into it as well. This makeup deal that we've got on Chaney was originally, you know, really earmarked for Hull in Werewolf of London, you know, of course, because of just, the story in that where he had to be recognizable, it really didn't make sense to have that full, you know, werewolf garb. So,
I think it's an evolution. So I think without Henry Hull's makeup in Werewolf of London, you don't get this one, which is, you know, there are makeups that are amazing and really skillful and incredible. And then there are makeups that are iconic. And this one obviously is an icon.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned Frankenstein Monster again. That's probably, well put, the Mona Lisa, but my gosh, this one here is just incredible. Just a great, amazing. Great job by Pierce. And, you know, the facial features of Chaney, it was just a
master. Well, his ability to express and emote through all that is critical. And the idea that you still look past that makeup and you see Lawrence Talbert inside, you know, underneath the fur and the fangs and everything. And I think that without that, it's critical. The film doesn't have the weight and impact and longevity and everything else that it does. So, okay. Anyway, moving on.
Very true. No, I mean, Chaney to me, he's got great eyes. He always emotes sympathy. And I mean, you saw it in Man Made Monster and he just has these great, great eyes. Of course, when he's, you know, full blown, you know, werewolf, wolfman, man, he just looks like a hungry, savage beast. So just a fantastic job. Yeah, let's get into this. So kind of a cool start. We do the kind of live opening credits showing all the actors. And then we've got an opening of an encyclopedia or maybe a dictionary.
Right.
And they pan right to the word lycanthropy. And it kind of gives you the definition of exactly what that means for those who don't know what lycanthropy is, because it's certainly mentioned quite a few times in the film. But it's basically, long story short, definition of a man who either literally physically changes or believes he can change into a wolf. And yes, we can certainly get into it later on in the film. But I think originally during the script, Jim, they weren't sure what they were doing as far as whether or not Talbot was going to be literally physically changing or if it was going to be all in his mind. So I'd heard that a little bit before watching the film and doing some research for the podcast, but that was really, really cool to kind of, you know, rediscover that fact.
I had heard that as well. And that, I won't give spoilers away, but Universal does employ that kind of device in a latter werewolf film, which may or may not feature a female werewolf. No spoilers though. What a shame that would have been though, right? Come on. It's just a dream. I'm glad wiser heads prevailed.
But it's funny, it's like, you know, kind of a pet peeve of mine, and I was never, I mean, you never want to overthink these films, but you know, and I'm gonna fast forward a little bit, like the Bella in this film, of course, is a werewolf, and we'll get there. But you know, his transformation, he is literally a four-legged wolf running around. Yes. He looks like a wolf. Lon Chaney Jr. is not a four-legged wolf. He's a stand-up, you know, truly wolf man, And that was going to play into that original script that, you know, it might have played maybe a little bit better if this was truly all in his mind, that he was not a four-legged beast. He was, you know, this was all, and they talk about it quite a bit, like Sir John talks about quite a bit, that it's, you know, the getting lost in the mazes of the mind. And
yeah,
you know, I'm just wondering how many lines that, you know, are in that from that original cut where they're
right. And but you know, luckily it lands as it is, where you know, again, like Dracula's Daughter and like some other Universal films, this film really is about the intersection of science and legend and myth and superstition, and how, you know, those uncomfortable bedfellows kind of try to marry together. And Universal, as usual, just does this amazing job of welding these things together. And you know, this to me is that perfect example of what we call the Universal pocket universe, where there's telescopes looking at space, and there's people riding like horse-drawn wagons in the same square footage almost.
Isn't that amazing? Right.
Yeah. And you never go like, it's subconsciously, you're like, oh, okay. You never consciously go like, wait, that's so, hang on a minute. I think it exists in that perfect zone and describes this conflict that is maybe as old as man, you know, the idea of like invention and modernization versus tradition. Anyway.
Yeah. It almost feels,
and I think those are perfectly emblemized by Sir John and by, Maliva, like those two polars.
Exactly.
They're like the two figures on Larry's shoulders, you know, either way, pulling him one way, the other direction and stuff. And
yeah, no,
and,
you,
and, yeah, battling
exactly
for his
right.
Soul.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I mean, Sir John, you know, again, we're going to fast forward a little bit, but I promise we'll take a step back. But you get in his office, some of the scenes between John and Larry, and it's almost steampunk. Like the whole backdrop is like this huge constellation.
Oh yeah,
of you know, just astronomy, just like this master of science, and like you mentioned, just that huge telescope.
Yeah,
and then meanwhile, down the road, you have the villagers with the pitchforks and the mm-hmm, torches. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, but John is he's a man of science who also is a man of faith too, and I think there's an interesting chink in his logical armor, let's say. So. But we should get into the narrative here.
Let's go. So yeah, opening scene, we've got a car ride, I guess a prodigal son returning home. So Larry Talbert, 18 years away in America, he's been working in a kind of observation, working kind of a astronomy, is it more of a hands-on, you know, mechanic engineer type, but returning home to his father's estate, the Talbot Manor, to meet Sir John. So we learn that Larry's brother John has died in a hunting accident. And Larry, you know, very much like the royal hierarchy, Larry's next in line to take over the estate from, you know, his dad. So yeah, he's returning home, and it's been 18 years since, you know, father and son have met. So they have kind of a, you know, a little bit of a strained, you know, at least a opening start, but you know, they certainly quickly warm up to each other, and you know,
yeah, I will say that you know, having watched this movie 40 times at least, if not more, I don't know, you lose count, watching it again this last week, you know, and making notes, almost my favorite part of the last time I watched it is watching the relationship between Sir John and Larry, and the interaction between Claude Rains and Lon Chaney, two amazing actors. The chemistry between them, like, you know, as someone who has worked on a, you know, directed, you can't really, you can try to force that and kind of get close to it. But if it's not naturally there, you're never going to 100% get there. And it is 100% there between these two really gifted actors. There's all the history and the maybe bad blood and baggage of the past that exists in these scenes between Claude Rains and Lon Chaney. But at the same time, there's this amazing rapport that they have that you believe that there was a time where they were very close and that they interacted all the time and you know, could kind of like finish each other's sentences and stuff. It's really miraculous. And Claude Rains just brings in this his second Universal film, right after Invisible Man, right. He brings this quiet dignity to the film and to his character that just it roots you down into the story right away as soon as you know Larry and him start having this conversation and stuff. And I think it would have been easy for this film to have for other latter iterations of this movie, more recent ones went this way a little bit, to have the father be antagonistic and have their relationship be, you know, have acrimony or tension. And the thing I absolutely love about this movie is that Sir John never ever gives up on his son ever to the end. He always believes him. He knows he's going through troubles. He's got problems and he's there for him. And it's really I think it's the emotional core. I know, like, you know, there's the romance with Evelyn Anker's character, but it's really the emotional core of the story is really a story of a father and a son. And for Lon Chaney Jr. to be playing this, you know, being the son of a very famous man himself, kind of existing still at this point in the shadow, that I don't know. I think he falls into it very naturally, and it's really just it's one of the most enjoyable things in the film for me.
It is. I mean, this is one thing I think that holds Wolfman up over so many films is just, I mean, so the actors, actresses, but the chemistry between Chaney and Anchors, you mentioned the chemistry between Chaney and Rains is just off the charts. And one thing I've always appreciated with this film, Chaney Jr. is a huge man. He's 6'2", probably, 210, 220. Rains is not a, you know, large man, 5'7", 5'8". But when they go, you know, I don't say toe to toe, but when they're speaking to each other, you know, Chaney has probably 6-7 inches on Rains, but just the weight and the bravado of Rains.
Yeah.
Absolutely outshines. I mean, there is no doubt when you're watching these two men act, but these characters in the film.
Yeah.
Chaney feels like a little boy, right?
Who's in charge? Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
I mean, you know who's in charge. I mean, just that's just a tribute to Rains's ability to, you know, to act through just that sheer weight and just the confidence. I mean, he is just brings like this leader. Ship
absolutely
to the film, which is really, really nice. And again, I think a strength of Chaney, and you know you saw it in Mice and Men and even Man Made Monster, as he can kind of play the simple is not the right word, but kind of like the everyman, right?
He's not very much an everyman. Larry Talbot is not a big thinker, right. And that's not a diss on him. He's a straightforward guy, and he's caught up in something very, very esoteric that is beyond his understanding, and he struggles with it quite a bit. It's on the universal on the disc for the commentary. I think it's Rudy Belmer. I'm not sure who does the commentary for Wolfman, but at this point he makes a funny comment about, you know, Lon Chaney Jr. being the son of you know, Claude Rains, and wondering what did the mother look like. But again, you know, Lon Chaney Sr. was not a large man, and Lon Chaney Jr. came out of him. And so, you know, maybe this is just healthy living. I don't know.
Jenny Hall, like maybe Jenny Hall from Invisible Man. Like she's got more of the, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. But they make a comment in the movie when he meets, Ralph Bellamy's character and stuff, like, oh, he's really well grown, isn't he? Yeah, he's pretty big. He's going to be able to lift the whole house and stuff. My other thing, I promise everybody we'll get into the actual story of the film. My other thing is, I think this movie only works because Larry is a stranger in a strange land. He's this you know, scion that has returned from years and years away, and nobody knows who he is. Nobody trusts him. He looks different. He stands out like a sore thumb in this town, this little Welsh town. He doesn't sound like anybody. He doesn't act like anybody. He doesn't have an accent. He doesn't have, you know, he's an outsider from the get-go anyway. And then on top of that, there's everything that happens. And I think that suspiciousness that the villagers have for him naturally from the start is the jumping off factor that makes the film. So if he was just a member of the village, he was just like the Lord's son, then this happened. This would seem like every Guy de Maupassant story that you've ever read, or, you know, like right. a classic kind of Gothic literature. Him being the expat, yeah, really shakes it up.
Yeah, he's like the fish out of water, you know, the returning prodigal son. And I guess in one of the early versions of the script, he was not originally going to be Rains' son. He was not going to be any relation to Sir John. He was just, he was an engineer. So Sir John
brought in for the telescope,
with his telescope, and literally hired this guy, Larry. I don't know if his name would have been Larry Talbert. It might have been Sir John Smith, whatever. Mm-hmm. But there was originally not going to be any relation between Sir John and Larry. He was just an engineer there to fix the telescope. And probably the rest of the story unfolds as it does. He, you know, meets Arlen Anchors through kind of perverse circumstances, and which we'll get through. But
we'll get to that.
Yeah,
we'll get to that bit of awkwardness.
No, but originally, yeah, the original script was not no relation between, between Sir John and Larry.
Yeah, very interesting.
So he's there. Prodigal son returns, and right off the bat, they start working on Sir John's telescope, which we mentioned before. Certainly, a man of high IQ, high intelligence, higher learning.
He won some kind of award,
The Nobel
the Belton Prize. I think they mentioned. I'm not sure if that's real or if that's a made up thing. We should look that up. Anybody listening who knows, is the Belton Prize real or made up? Let us know. Hit us up.
Let us know. But yeah, so Larry's up there, and he readily admits, I'm not a book guy. I'm more, I'm a mechanic. I'm a guy with my hands. So, right off the bat, Larry's, as we mentioned before, kind of the simple guy, and he's just a working class man, and
who can nevertheless install a refractory lens in a telescope. You can say you're like a man who works with your hands, but there's a certain amount of brilliance that comes with that.
That's true. Yeah. Well, this brilliant. Yeah, the brilliant Sir John's like, holy crap! How did you do that? Like, how the hell did you have to get that lens in there, boy?
He sees his capableness, and he thinks he'll be great. And Sir John has a great line here about how when it comes to the heavens, there's only one expert or something, which is nice. Again, it underlines this idea that he has this underlying faith while being a man of a modern, modern man of science and stuff. And I think that's that first step he takes towards where he's going to have to go in this film.
Exactly right. So yeah, the scene. So Larry's working on the telescope. Sir John excuses himself, and Larry is, kind of putting the telescope to the test. And rather than, I guess, looking at the stars, he's kind of poking around this little village. And long story short, ends up, in the window of Evelyn Anchors, Miss Gwen Cotliffe. So Larry is the peeping Tom of the village now, and
not so much a man of science as a man of And I think perversity. That is again this idea of like this 1930s 40s idea of like the virility of a man.
Right.
There's gonna be a lot of stuff with Evelyn with Gwen Cotliffe, I should say, that to it again through a 2021 lens comes off a little skidgy, but
a little bit. Yeah, I mean, she's in the window, no shades, just doing her thing and looking all pretty. And so Larry's like, all right, let's whatever. My first beautiful woman I've seen in the village. So he goes right over to. So she's works at an antique shop. Her dad has an antique shop, family run business. So heads over to the shop, and man, he pours it on really thick. I was kind of keeping notes here. Like, I got to use some of these one liners that Larry's using. He's good, man. He's really good.
He definitely doesn't understand that no means no. I think that concept has not entered into his thinking yet. He comes off charming. I know he's not an anachronism. He's an oddball in this thing. And I'm sure this town doesn't see a whole lot of, folks from elsewhere. Quick question for you, Scott. I don't believe they never mention the village by name in this film. I think it's Werewolf or Frankenstein versus the Wolfman. When they give it a name, they call it Lenwilly Village, right?
Yes, I don't think they do. Yeah, and I was often wondering if it was named out like a Talbot Village or something. Yeah, I don't believe they ever do. And that's
Talbotville,
again, if somebody knows any differently, then obviously, as Jim had mentioned, future films that they do give it a name. But 1941 Wolfman, if they name this village, I'd be shocked. Maybe there's a street sign somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah,
good question.
But I was listening for it. I didn't hear it. I'm not sure if they even really nail it down in Wales where it does end up, kind of existing in the latter films. It's a story about this Welsh town where this happens. And as someone of Welsh, my family's of Welsh extraction, that was always like, oh man, this is the story of my people. And I always admired that and stuff like that. Yeah, no, it's just an interesting thing. They kind of went back and rebuilt a little bit of that universe, a stronger when they come back and a few years later for Frankenstein and the Wolfman. So,
but it's kind of, I mean, obviously Wolfman is an American film, but you know, a lot of, you know, you see like some Japanese made films or, you know, even English or, you know, German made films. It's always the American actor. They kind of show up and they're like, you know, they've got like the ego and they're very brass and exactly. Yes. And Larry's kind of the same thing, you know, the same way just in this whole scene, you know, I always want Evelyn Anchors. Gwen is very much like the English, you know, the sweet, you know, white snow, you know, virginal woman here, you know, very, very classy. And Larry's then like, oh, gee, oh, hey, girl, what big eyes you have. And, you know,
a bit of a rogue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Evelyn Anchors, the Welsh girl who does not have really an accent. She does a little bit of that mid-Atlantic thing. Just a bit. Everyone else is pretty. And obviously the funny thing about Len Willy Village is that every single person in the village knows about werewolves. There's everyone you run into is going to quote that poem to you. Evelyn, you know, Gwen Conliff does, Jenny Williams does, Claude Rains, with the exception of Paul Mumford, who seems to have no understanding what anyone's talking about. Werewolves, gypsies, what are we talking about? Yeah.
He just wants to hunt. He wants to kill something. He wants like a werewolf head for his wall.
Yeah, and you need that character in this. This last viewing of the film, I really just liked Paul Mumford for some reason. I never had that strong a reaction to him, but I'm like, man, what a jerk that guy is. But you need that character. It's okay.
Yeah, he's actually very American. He's almost more American than Larry, quote unquote. When I say American, quote unquote American, you know.
Yeah,
no, he's exactly. Like the manly man. He just wants to grab a beer and go hunting for werewolves. And
right. And he and Larry were childhood friends. You know, they stole apples together, I guess, or something. You know, so they go back and interestingly, it turns out that he might be Larry's main antagonist in this thing. He's the one who seems to be most as Larry goes through his problems, most adamant that Larry be committed or confined or prosecuted or something. Yeah.
He's
definitely not on Larry's side like John is.
No, I mean, he certainly had, you know, we'll get to it, but Larry starts breaking down emotionally. And you know, even Dr. Lloyd at one point says, you know, no more questions for now. And you know, Larry really has to rest. And, you know, Paul is just, he can answer my questions now. And, you know,
he's a man of the law. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Larry goes and buys a cane as a way to kind of get to know Gwen Conliff and stuff. And ironically, he buys this very iconic, well-known cane, this silver-handled werewolf, like cane with the image of a werewolf and the pentagram, which is the sign of the werewolf. And this is where we get Gwen first reciting the "Even a Man Who Is Pure in Heart" poem to him, and this is, again, all new news to Larry as well. Larry's never heard of werewolves. Larry's never, you know, he's never been exposed to these kind of local legends, of course, growing up spending so much time rather in America.
All right. Yeah. No, again, she knows a poem. "Even a man who is pure at heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright." And we hear that quite a few times in this film. Like you said, everyone just seems to. Yeah. I mean, it must just be a legend of this little town.
Which has changed a little bit in the next film. They change it to "when the moon is full and bright." They take autumn out of it, assumingly because maybe it's not autumn anymore. So you have to have a caveat.
Yeah, and again, so I'm glad you brought that up, Jim. So, another one of the rewrites of the script was that it wasn't going to be a full moon that caused the change of the wolf. It was the season. So, I think the belief was going to be this is just, you know, maybe you're entering the autumn season. So, I think that's probably why they added that into the poem, and then later went back to rewrite it that it was a full moon. That I mean, this is again this film here brought in a lot of the tropes of the werewolf. I mean, he's a werewolf of London, really wasn't, you know, I mean, they had like the moonlight, I guess, or the moon ray.
Had the moonlight. Yeah. But without these films, you know, and we cover this a lot and I went on and on ad nauseum about it in Werewolf of London. I won't belabor the point now in case everyone's heard that as well. But yeah, literally very few of the traditional legends about werewolves are what we associate with them now. This film and Werewolf of London to some degree brought in like a pop culture mythology to the werewolf, where it turned him into a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde character. It became something that was an affliction rather than something sought out. Normally in legends, people turn into werewolves were doing it on purpose for various reasons. the full moon is it just a total, as far as I can tell, invention of the screenwriters from Universal.
Definitely.
Silver bullet, you know, all these tropes. This is just, again, like, you know, there's no classic piece of literature that the werewolf legend is based on, like Universal used for Frankenstein and for Dracula, and then other studios used for Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, etc., Hunchback of Notre Dame. They had to make it all up. and for what they did a pretty good job, because now these are the things that we all associate with werewolfism. We don't even question it. And not for these films, we wouldn't have it.
Absolutely. And it's a great, great point. We don't have to belabor it now, but go back, guys, go back and listen to Werewolf of London, because we do dig into it quite a bit, where that was the first werewolf story. And, you know, we get into kind of the old, you know, the historical, you know, some of the old books of, you know, the old time werewolves, really, mm-hmm. Going back to, you know, Scotland and in Ireland. And it's really a neat story. And I definitely ask anyone to go on, you know, just Google it up. And it's some really, really fascinating reading.
In an amazing age, just Wikipedia it and spend some time. It's fascinating.
So I want to go back to the flirting here. So Larry is, you know, he's working on his girl. He bought the cane. So kind of an important scene that comes up. So he said, I'll be back at 8 o'clock. There's a fair, there's gypsies in town. So there's going to be some kind of like a little carnival or, you know, kind of a little show that Larry would like to go to. So he keeps repeating it to Gwen. I'll come back at 8. She's like, no, I can't go out. Oh, yeah, you are. You're going to come out with me. She's like, no, I don't want to go out with you. Yeah, you are. I'll be back at 8. Shuts the door. So I don't know. So Larry and
no means no, Larry.
Hey, he's a cut of the Talbert. So, you know, no means maybe.
This is true.
So Gwen is, you know, we learn is engaged. So she's got some, you know, for good reason. So doesn't want to be seen on town with this guy, but doesn't exactly turn him down. So 8 o'clock comes, Larry, you know, goes in front of the store and Gwen comes out and, you know, I guess to kind of cock block him a bit, invites her friend Jenny.
That's right.
We'll see in some other films later on. So
coincidentally, the first girl I had a crush on in fifth grade was named Jennifer Williams.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know where she's at now.
Did she get killed by listening, a wolf?
Yeah.
Hopefully she didn't get killed by a wolf.
She didn't kill by a werewolf. let's hope. So they're going to, I mean, ostensibly go on like it's not a double date. It's just, she's chaperoning them just so that there's not the auspice of inappropriateness and stuff. I'm going to stop just for a second and just say that the film does make numerous references to this group of fortune tellers that come to town. Maria Ospenskaya and Bella are members of their group. It uses the word gypsy a whole lot. Gypsy is a kind of a slur of a word. It comes from the root word gyp as well. So it basically assigns this idea of thievery to this group of people who are actually called the Romani, and who have been persecuted and exterminated to a large degree over time and stuff. So, you know, for my purposes, I'm mostly going to call them fortune tellers, just because I don't. I think they've suffered enough. We don't need to add to that and stuff like that. But that moving forward, when I say fortune tellers, you can all know I'm referring to them, and I'm not trying to be overly PC. It's just there's a bit of a sensitivity there. So yeah. Anyway.
No, thank you.
Fortune tellers.
I appreciate that, Jim. And, you know, no, absolutely. That's a great point. And I'll certainly echo your sentiment.
I don't think it was seen as a slur at the time of the film. Obviously, this is, you know, a more recent sensitivity. But yeah. Yeah. So they're going to go and have their fortunes told, obviously, at this. And it's kind of a fair thing. And we see it again, you know, after the next night or two. And there's some, like shooting galleries and stuff. So it's basically like, the carnival comes to town, right?
Sure. So Jenny and I always want to call Evelyn Akers, but you know, Gwen and Jen go to the show, and we for the first time meet Bella, who, you know, obviously Bella Lugosi is one of the fortune tellers. So Maria Ospenskaya, of course, is kind of the queen bee of we'll call it the carnival, and Bella is her son. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right off the bat, Jenny Williams goes in and has her fortune read by Bella, and Larry and, you know, Gwen kind of step off and, you know, just kind of get to know each other a little bit more and et cetera. So, you know, as time goes on, Bella, you know, starts feeling the effects of the full moon. And this scene, I never really, and again, I don't want to overthink things. I don't want to be overly sensitive, but Bella, you know, the character Bella here has been afflicted, you would assume, for quite some time.
Yes.
We'll call it werewolfery.
Werewolfery. I thought we were past that, but okay.
No.
We're back to werewolfery.
No, we're back. So werewolfery knows. So of course knows he's afflicted. Knows it's the night of the full moon. maybe not the best time to be given fortunes.
I have a note of that in my notes that is all in caps as well. Okay. it seems irresponsible on his part.
Right.
But it's what moves our story forward.
It does. But Balor, of course, given the fortune and sees, you know, so he's holding his head and you can see the pentagram, like the scar on his forehead, yeah. Assuming that's maybe where he was bitten by, you know, the wolf that transformed him.
Have a theory about it.
Sure, like, let's hear it.
The theory about it. So on the way to the fair, to the carnival tents, to the fortune tellers, Jenny Williams stops and picks up a bunch of a wolfbane. And again, we have the, the man's pure heart when the wolf may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright. Is there a possibility that Bella, the gypsy, kind of has this thing under control? Maybe he's figured out something. He drinks the right teas or what have you. And Jenny bringing the wolfbane into the tent, because there's a moment where Bella looks down and he just, in very amazing Bella, like with those hands of his, that motion, picks up the wolfbane and kind of moves it over to the other side.
Right.
So it's not in his face. Is there a possibility that maybe he would have been okay, but the wolfbane somehow busted his zen or something?
Wow. Like
I'm searching really hard for a rationalization, but I could almost sell myself on that.
No, I never thought of it that way. I mean, that's a great thought. I mean, again, even, you know, later on after, you know, we'll get there when Bella is killed by Larry, and she gives him the little amulet to say, you know, this will protect you. So I think that's a great thought, Jim, that maybe, you know, they did between Bella and, you know, Husband Sky, they had it under control, and maybe Jenny doing that or, you know, something triggered him off.
I mean, messed up his mojo.
Wolfman country now.
Yeah.
That's a great thought. Interesting.
Yeah, it's just a theory. I was thinking about it this last time. So anyway, he gets partway through Jenny's fortune. Jenny just wants to know when she's going to be married, of course. And, you know, and he's like, I will tell you tomorrow. Go away now. So like halfway through, she's like, she's paid him and everything. He's like, no more fortune. You go now. She's like, can we talk about how amazing Bela looks in this movie, by the way? Like that. He's not unrecognizable because he's Bela Lugosi and, you know, hey, but the mustache and the everything, the earring and stuff like that, like he just sells Gypsy so well. And these are like a lot of the parts he would play early on in his stage career, and then early on in some silent stuff when he came to America. He would play these ethnic characters, let's call them. And he just, he just floats into it so well. I mean, what is Bella's 57 here or 56 or something? I'd have to go back and do the math and everything. But yeah, you know.
He's something like that. I think he's only 6 years or 7 years younger than Maliva, who's supposed to be his mom, which is kind of
right, right, of course. Which we'll get into Maria Auspenskaya, hopefully, here in a bit. Come back tomorrow.
Right.
There's an innate tragedy in Bella that foreshadows the tragedy that will fall onto, you know, Larry Talbot, of course. This the curse, right? So anyway, he chases her out of the tent. She runs away. Gwen and Larry are off, you know, canoodling a little bit by a tree. And then we see this amazing shot from a little ways off of Bella standing there with his back to camera, holding his face.
Yeah.
And we know what's happening and stuff. And the other thing I think this film is emblematic of is the set design, the Gothic set design of Universal films. This, because rural Wales looks like rural Pennsylvania, if anyone's ever been there. It's just rolling hills and mountains and forests, and it's green and lush and really lush because it rains all the time there, and it's absolutely gorgeous. And of course here it's this foggy moor with these gnarly twisted trees and this, you know, the stylization that Universal was not afraid to bring to these films always amazes me. It's very brave and it's done so well that you don't question it, but you're like, where it looks like this and why would you live here? Like, this is awful looking.
No, but I mean, they did not cheap out, as you've mentioned. Looking at Bella, just the detail, the clothes, the mustache, everything. They did
all the fortune tellers, the outfits are amazing.
Yeah, everything. This is, of course, on a sound stage, but just beautiful. Like you said, just mentioned that just the gothicness. They did not cheap out, and you know, obviously, there are some films that are, you know, about to come up in the Universal, film guide here, where they definitely cheaped out.
We've talked about a few of the films that struggled against the limitations of their budget, and this is not one of those. This was a pretty prestige picture. I don't know this for sure, but the conventional way to make fog lay down low on the ground, like you have in this whole film. So there's basically a soundstage devoted to this forest, this moor, whatever that all these scenes take place on, is to chill it. So conceivably, I'm not sure. Well, soundstages in general, if you've never been on a soundstage, soundstages are kept very cold anyway, because the lights are really hot. So you keep the temperature really cold. So when the lights come on, it kind of moderates, right? In addition to that, if they were actually refrigerating it a bit to keep this thing cool, you have to realize that Evelyn Ankers and all these actors and Bella and Maria Ospenskaya on these sets were probably pretty chilly.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not always a pleasant experience. Yeah.
I mean, Evelyn Ankers, of course, had a pretty scary incident later on in the film that we can get into. But Bella does the transformation off screen, and Bella's wolf is literally a four legged wolf.
It's a doggy werewolf.
It's a doggy werewolf. Doggy werewolf.
It's on the doggy side, but is that because he's been a werewolf so long? Who knows? I don't know.
It's possible. Yeah. I mean, attacks Jenny. We've learned later on that,
He can't have been a werewolf that long because he's Maria Ospenskaya's son and she's only 150. So
Bella's at least what, 85.
I don't know. So maybe for 20 years or so.
Possibly.
So, I will say that for all of Larry Talbot's kind of horn dogginess, let's say, the sketchiness of that part of his character, when Jenny is attacked, he immediately rushes to her aid without a thought for himself and tries to rescue her at great risk and obviously a great, expense for himself. So there's a valor and a bravery to this character that it's again, one of those things that, I think this movie hit just and made such a lasting impression for many reasons. But I think one of them is just because the Larry Talbot character is so compelling. You wish you knew the guy. You really wish you could hang out with Larry Talbot, possibly not on a full moon night. And because he's just a gregarious, friendly guy. And that's what Cheney Jr. brings to the role.
Yeah. I mean, you see it on a lot of Cheney roles. Like it always seems like there's a point in the story that he just kind of goes off this cliff and never ever recovers from. I mean, like the Wolfman, man-made monster, like he's always this happy-go-lucky kind of simplistic person.
Yeah.
Something happens to him, a tragedy happens, and then he never ever returns to that light form. Like I said, he's kind of the laughy, he's almost like he's ready to join like a frat house or something.
Oh yeah. Oh no, for sure. Yeah. No, he's that guy. Yeah. And I think a lot of that, I think he or someone else figured out, I don't know what, when he did Of Mice and Men with Burgess Meredith in that came out in 38 or 39, I want to say. I know everyone listening to this is a big horror fan, but hopefully you're also classic movie fans. And while Of Mice and Men, the Burgess Meredith Lon Chaney Jr. version is not a horror film, go watch it. It's an incredible version of the Steinbeck story. And you can see why it jumpstarted Lon Chaney Jr.'s career. Mm-hmm. He's as Lenny. He's alternately adorable and horrifying in it. Lenny's a mentally challenged or a character who works as a kind of a itinerant farmhand kind of guy and has a smaller helper, but he's a big dude. And something happens and he finally loses his temper and there's this latent danger inside Lenny because he's such a big guy and he doesn't have the mental capacity to maybe understand how powerful he is and stuff. Cheney Jr. is incredible in it. And that's definitely, I think people saw that and went, hey, hang on, this guy isn't just the son of this legendary actor. This guy is his own thing. Totally dissimilar from his dad.
Absolutely. And I think that film went down as, Cheney years and years later, Cheney Jr., I should say, years and years later, he always cited that as his favorite film.
I think he was most proud of that and rightfully so. It might not be his most iconic character, but it's an iconic performance that he gave that's really impressive.
100%. Yeah. No, if you're a Cheney fan again, definitely check that out. Yeah. So, going back
and, to- And on the flip side of that and Spider Baby, I would say the 60, I can't remember, 60 film, those two films really, the beginning and the end of Cheney's career, bracket his career and just, they're both amazing performances
for sure. So let's get back to poor Jenny. So she's been killed by the Bella dog, Bella dog wolf.
Bella dog.
And Larry runs over and of course to attempt to rescue Jenny and has this battle with the wolf dog. And actually, so it's his dog in real life was kind of cool. So his dog So Chaney had a dog named Moose, this huge German shepherd. So all those close-up scenes of him, you know, wrestling, he's got these kind of, you know, nose-to-nose, you know, with this, you know, quote-unquote wolf dog. That was his dog, Moose, who you see actually in some other movies. Which
didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, his dog, Moose.
So they're just like, you know, playing, but, you know.
Totally playing, yeah. But, okay. You know, Chaney does some great acting, and he's, you know, pushes him down and ultimately beats the wolf off with his silver cane that he bought from Gwen. And then, you know, kind of a lot of confusion ensues, I guess, as we kind of enter the second act of the film.
Yeah. I mean, this is the inciting action here of, you know, Larry just happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And this thing happens. I mean, the weird course of events that has led him to this, his brother, you know, dying tragically and him coming all the way back to, you know, Britain to do this. And then just happening going to the gypsy camp and I'm sorry, to the fortune teller camp. See, I did it. And then, you know, he's laying there. Gwen kind of runs and finds him and he's all injured. And there, you know, he says, Jenny. And then here comes Maria Ospenskaya in her little horse-drawn carriage, kind of rolling up the thing. Scott, talk about Maria for a minute.
Yeah. So, I mean, Maria is we know the head, you know, fortune teller, but really has been the protector of her son, Bella. They, you know, she's known for however many years it is that he's been cursed with, you know, the curse of the werewolf. So she's, you know, kind of the protector of Bella now with his death, you know, understands, you know, the whole, you know, the curse that if someone who is bitten and survives the bite of a werewolf becomes a werewolf themselves. So Maria immediately knows that Larry ultimately is going to become a werewolf. And it comes kind of plays out a little bit more later on in the film, yeah. You know, kind of becomes his protector, kind of his shadow that she shows up. She's kind of watching him from afar that, you know, just as kind of a model. So we'll get there. So yeah, he thinks that he's killed a wolf. And as you said, Maria kind of comes out and there's a scene, next scene back at Talbot Castle, the Talbot Estates, of Larry in bed and, you know, gets up and the policemen come in, Paul and, you know, Sir John and everything to kind of.
Well, they bring him home and he kind of collapses.
Right.
And they're like, what's happening? You know, Ralph Bellamy's character is there, you know, and it's like, oh, he's bitten by a wolf, like a wolf. There's no wolves here and stuff. You know, Ralph Bellamy is the ultimate doubter that, you know, she's like, yeah, the gypsy woman brought us. And like, what gypsy woman? Because Maliva is darted off, obviously.
Right.
And so, you know, they bring the servants down and they bring Larry up and stuff. And then, so he wakes up the next day in a bit of a daze and stuff. Now we have a little scene there before this, right, with Paul Mumford and with
Dr. Lloyd.
No, it's what's the Twiddles, right? Twiddles is his second in command guy who seems very ill suited to police work.
Right,
he seems pretty squeamish.
Yeah, take this down, Twiddle. Yeah, he's looking over Jenny's body.
I don't know.
Twiddle, what are you doing? I'm very
squeamish. Yeah, except a note, he is not suited for police work. Right. and they investigate the crime scene. They find the cane that Larry used to club Bella dog to death.
And of course, no dog, no wolf. There's Bella.
No wolf. Yeah, and they find Bella. With no shoes on. So there's an initial understanding that there a decision made that Jenny was attacked by a wolf. Because they can see she was attacked by a wolf. You know, she has marks on her body that she was basically
just right. Killed by Larry's I mean, Larry's jacket's ripped open. He was clearly there was an animal attack.
Yeah. And that Bella and Larry, the thinking is Bella and the thinking without a whole lot of, I mean, Paul Mumford kind of jumps to the conclusion, but okay. That's police work in the sticks, I guess. That Bella and Larry both came to her rescue. There's confusion. Larry clubs Bella to death, thinking he's a wolf apparently in the dark.
Yeah.
And it's just an unfortunate accident. And of course, because Bella is a fortune teller, there's not going to be like any kind of a formal inquiry about it, right? Because he's not considered exactly a citizen of the realm or something.
Sir John makes it very, I mean, he's like ready to sweep this thing under the rug way, way too easy. He's like, yeah, this happened. Bella's dead. And then this happened. Oh, you know, whatever. Like,
it's a shame, but my son is going to be a lord one day. And, you know, maybe you don't want to mess with him too much. Cause that is the, you know, the latent thing underneath all this going on is this idea that Sir John is not the youngest man in the world. At some point, he was going to pass on his title or whatever to Larry. Larry is going to be Lord Talbot someday.
He's Prince Charles.
Gargantuan, awkward, weird American expatriate guy. Sure. He's going to be the Lord of this village. Sure. So it's a funny thing that hangs over everything else.
Yeah. So basically the police inspector, Dr. Lloyd, Paul, Sir John meet Larry in the bedroom to kind of figure out what is going on here. Larry comes home and as Jim had mentioned, kind of comes through the door being held up by Gwen saying he's been attacked by a wolf. Yet on the crime scene, there's two dead bodies. There's no wolf. There's Larry's cane. So they're trying to figure out exactly what's going on. So Larry immediately kind of pulls open his shirt and says, well, this is where the wolf bit me. And of course, there's no wound. I'm assuming there's a scar, a kind of a pentagram shaped scar, which no one seems to, or Dr. Lloyd makes no mention of. But,
yeah,
you know, obviously,
which we do see later. Yeah.
Yes, you see it later. But yeah, you think if Larry was bitten by a wolf, of course, he would be bloody. There'd be, some gore or something. There's nothing.
Right. And it's obviously it is healed up very quickly because now he is a werewolf and he will heal very quickly from these types of, of things.
Yeah. So again, you wonder, you know, we mentioned earlier of the script here, it was made possibly all in Larry's mind. So this is, you know, it's kind of interesting. The screenwriters came to a fork in the road to determine if it's going to be more of a psychological thriller horror or if he's actually physically changing into a
visceral horror, which. Let's just be thankful they chose the way they did.
Of course. But at this point, you don't know because, I mean, there's no bite marks. There's really nothing to confirm. So it's kind of ambiguous at this point.
So Larry and Gwen are now caught up in this little bit of a scandal, right? In the tiny village, because it's known that they were out together while Jenny was killed. And it's known that Gwen obviously is engaged to somebody. So there's that. So there's a little bit of a to-do happening, right? Jenny Williams' mom, who seems to be this troublemaking spinster type lady who travels with a cadre of similar ladies.
Such a pill.
Widows and what have you. Wants to she's a woman in grief and she wants to blame somebody. So she is settled on Gwen and Larry, that it's their fault somehow that their daughter was killed by a wolf, while out, in the woods by herself, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, no. The spinster, God-fearing woman that wants to blame Gwen. It's like, you know, this is Gwen's fault that she left my daughter alone to be attacked by a wolf. It's all Gwen's fault.
Exactly. Which obviously is a little misplaced. But again, like she's a woman in pain. She's Mrs. Kidner slapping Chief Brody. Right?
Nice.
I'll make the comparison.
Jaws reference. Love it.
So there's a scene in the antique store the next day where this kind of thing is going down. Larry shows up to check on Gwen because now he's obviously feeling a lot better because he's a werewolf now and he's not that injured. And he kind of confronts these ladies and they kind of run away and chase him off and stuff. And this is really this is like the next stage in him being like this pariah in the village, right? Like without anyone even knowing that he's a werewolf yet. He's burning bridges and stuff with the people of the little village that he will be someday, conceivably lord of. I don't know who the actor's name who plays Gwen's father, Mr. Cunliffe. He's got this nice dignity to him. He's like, well, Larry's like, there's nothing wrong or anything. He's like, I trust my daughter. And he's like, of course you can see her and stuff. I like the quiet dignity of that guy's character. He doesn't have a lot to do, but
very protective of Gwen. Larry gets to the store, it's these, like you said, the spinster women, Jenny's mom comes in and it's like immediately your daughter, how dare you let your daughter go out without
that? I won't have any of that now.
That's right. Very protective
of his British rage. Ask you to leave now.
you will not besmirch my daughter's name.
Yes, no, exactly. And here's where we first get to really kind of have a scene with Frank Andrews shows up. Frank Andrews is Gwen's fiance, and he's the gamekeeper on the Talbot estate. So he shows up and sort of runs into Larry. And you have this awkward moment where first of all, so he brings the dogs and the dogs start barking at Larry. So and as we know from Man-Made Monster, as soon as the dogs stop liking Lon Chaney Jr., he's in trouble, right?
Yeah, I mean, dogs, animals are just, that much more intelligent. I mean, they can sniff out a good person.
They sense person, something's so wrong with it.
They do.
Yeah, for sure. Something's not right. So and just, and honestly, it's like they would at a strange dog, too. Like, a dog will be friendly to a person, but if you introduce a strange dog into their territory, they're suddenly going to, get defensive and feel challenged. And I think Larry now seems to, to a dog, Larry Talbot now seems like a much, much bigger dog that they have to, like, kind of whatever.
Well, it's funny, and Frank seems to share some of the dog's I don't know, he immediately thinks, or you know, knows that there's something up with Larry too, and he'll say it. Like at this one point, Larry puts out his hand, and Frank,
yeah,
it's not that he's like, you know, ghosting him, but he's just kind of mad. He's, you know, looks at that wolf cane and just says something extremely tragic about Larry. So he senses it too.
Patrick Knowles plays this character so well. Patrick Knowles, who would actually, you know, go on to play the Doctor in Frankenstein versus Wolfman, and he would play a different character in the next one. But he'd also just recently played Will Scarlet in the Robin Hood production, the Michael Curtiz one with Errol Flynn and Basil Rathbone. He's not the jealous type. Actually, he's sort of like a easygoing guy, and he seems to trust his, you know. And later on, when they go to the fair the next night, he's like, "Let's go hang out with Larry. I feel bad," you know, because right. He kind of gives him the blank stare, and Larry gets awkward and he leaves, and he just has that great line where he's like, "I feel like there's something tragic about that man. I feel like nothing good will come to you spending."
And he's also like, "I'm not screwing with my boss's son either, because he works for the Talbot Estate. There, I mean, who knows how easy jobs ought to come by?" So he's like,
"That's a valid point that I hadn't really considered."
Yeah, maybe
I kind of there's a funny moment where he walks away. He takes the dogs away because they were barking, right?
Yeah.
And Larry and Gwen are standing there, and he's like, "Seems like a nice guy. What does he do?" She's like, "He's the groundskeeper on your dad's estate." Like again, your reference to this idea that Larry is,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
he's sort of a big, without meaning to, he's a big deal in this town. Like he will be if things would follow through.
Of course.
I really like Patrick Knowles' performance, and I like his character.
I do too. He's good in this. Yeah, he was. I thought he was okay. I mean, Frankenstein, Wolfman, and I mean, he's been a couple of other pretty good movies. Yeah, I like him in this
plus
one.
To minus. I'm sorry, it's weird his recasting in the very next film as a completely different
exactly character. Right.
We see like Lionel Abel and a few other characters bounce around like that, but that was a pretty marked, interesting, odd choice.
Yeah, I mean, Larry comes back, obviously Marie Osmond Sky comes back as the same character, and then Patrick Knowles completely recast.
Yeah, maybe that's Frank Andrews is like long lost twin brother who did much better for himself and became
a doctor.
Larry also goes and visits the church where Bella's body is lying in the state. And there's an amazing scene where the priest is there with Maliva, and he's like, "Your people are going to come here dancing and singing and celebration. It's not Christian." And she's like, "This is how my people have done it for hundreds of years. I couldn't stop it if I wanted to. This is just, you know, this is our way."
Well, they call it like the peg, you know, you and your pagan rituals. And at some point she's called
fighting against sameness as hard as right. Fighting against superstition as hard as fighting against Satan himself. This,
like
this
you and your, witch, guy. Your witch's ways. And
And here's the first time, we hear the poem, the second poem. The film has two poems in it. It has the "Even a Man in His Shoes, Pure and Hard" one, and then Maliva has this beautiful thing that she says about the way you walked was thorny, through no fault of your own, and everything. It's like this kind of prayer she says over Bella's coffin as Larry kind of stands in the background and he hears it. And of course, we'll hear that reprised with Larry from her too.
Which is really sweet. Yeah, she'll say it a couple of times, and it seems to have some kind of magic influence or power influence.
It's like a chant. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, right. It's a chant. Larry, both times she'll say it to him, transforms back when he's stuck in the trap, and we'll get there. And then, of course, at the very end of the film, we'll get there too. But every time she chants that, you know, "The way you walk was thorny, no fault of your own," he transforms back, and he's unconscious both times. Or, you know, the second time he's supposedly dead, transforms to human form. So that's. That must have some magical, like a chant, like you said.
It brings a certain amount of peace or something. It's really sweet. And she's just awesome. I know precious little about Marie Ospenskaya. I know she was an acting teacher at one point in Hollywood. I know she lied about her age. Supposedly she. Do you know anything about this, Scott? Like, there's
not a ton. It does ring a bell. I think she was. Yeah, she looked quite a bit older.
Claimed to be a certain age, and then they found out that she. She's like a generation older than she.
Yeah, she's like 25, 30 years older than she was.
So
she got a little hot water.
There's some doubt as to how old she actually is at this moment in this film, and I don't know. I don't even know what a lot of else. I'll have to look up what else kind of stuff films and stuff she's done. I do think she was mostly a drama coach or acting teacher. And how amazing would it have been to take an acting class with Maria Ospenskaya? That would have been wild. She makes this film. She brings an authenticity, and I will say the film as far as the fortune teller characters, while it kind of treats them with a bit of a stereotype and paints them with a wide brush, the film is respectful to these characters, though, as well. It doesn't make them seem mean or cheap or cruel or sneaky or anything like that. It gives them very noble qualities. These characters.
Going to like House of Frankenstein, like they're literally like, you think of like there is a bunch of like the head fortune teller is literally a criminal. Like he's stealing, you know, coins and stuff like that. Yeah. Not the case here. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Not always done as respectfully. Yes,
exactly.
So it's missing. Yeah. And Larry, you know, and he almost has like a nervous breakdown over Bella's coffin and stuff like that. He's starting to crack a bit because he's starting to doubt the reality of what he knows he saw. Everyone is telling him that what he saw wasn't what he saw, and the stress of, you know, he has gone through like a traumatic incident, and they do say later in the film, like they're basically saying he has PTSD, what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sure.
But in addition to that, Larry's right. I mean, Larry knows everything throughout the rest of the film. He's saying like, Dad, I think I'm a werewolf. And, you know, he keeps trying to sort of explain what he's experiencing. And everyone's like, no, you're not. You're still, are you crazy? You're not doing that. And I think that is slowly, like, two things are happening. Larry is turning into a werewolf. And Larry's also sort of starting to lose his mind a little bit too under the stress of what's happening. And I don't think it helps that his dad and everyone he respects is telling him he's cuckoo here.
Right. No, I mean, Larry just killed. I mean, never mind being away again. Yeah. Being away 18 years and the stress of being with his dad again and trying re-entry, to, you know, just the weight of being a Talbert. He's just killed a man. You know, he's killed this fortune teller, Bela. So I think even, and it's a good point. I'd almost have to go back and relook at it. At this point, does he even have a clue that he might be a wolf man or, you know?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think he does either. I think this is when he breaks down at the, you know, when Maria Ospenskaya leaves and he's, you know, over Bela's tomb. I think it's just sorrow. Like he's just,
I think so.
Christ, I just killed a man. And
whether justified or not, or excusable or not. Yeah. I mean, he's crushed under that the guilt of that. And it's because he's this very decent man. You know?
Yeah. And certainly the start of his mental breakdown. That's exactly what's happening to him. Yeah.
So all this happens. And then sort of the next, we kind of move to the next night after a bit. And I think there's some stuff with John talking with the other guys about, you know, Larry and his mental condition and stuff. And we the next night, you know, the fortune tellers are still in town, and there's, you know, we have like kind of a big carnival scene where there's like, you know, games and stuff. Larry, or I should say Frank and Gwen are there together on a date as, you know, fiancés do. And Larry's there too, kind of by himself wandering around. I'm not sure why Larry's decided to go out again, but he has, and he's carrying his cane as well, oddly enough, the thing he murdered somebody with.
Big smile on his face. He's having a great time. He's long forgotten Bella, which is,
well, he is, and he's sort of a little sober and stuff. But here's that scene where, yeah, Frank is like, let's go. He's all alone. Let's go hang out. I want to show I don't have any hard feelings because he acted kind of weird with him and stuff. I know there was supposedly going to be a scene here where Larry fought a bear. The fortune tellers had a bear, and then somehow Larry gets into a fight with the bear. And I just want to be thankful that of all the things they decided to not include, that that's one of them. Because I feel like that would have been not only way off topic and distracting, but also awkward and strange.
Totally. I mean, I'm thinking like murder or murders in the zoo. They're just like, you would probably see some animal abuse that would make you and I extremely uncomfortable. And probably
either that or somebody in a terrible bear costume. I just watched Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer Boris Karloff last night, and there's a guy in a bear costume that Costello runs into in the caves, and it's just like, oh, please, can we just not?
The bear escaped. Like they were all ready to film the scene. The bear escaped. And actually, I don't know if it went after Evelyn Akers, but there was some story out there that she was like extremely, you know, I don't know if she was almost attacked or there's some horrific
story. They did
story.
Film it. They did film at least part of it or something before maybe someone was just like, this is stupid.
Yeah. But it wasn't real bear.
Just shut it down. I don't know. But I think the combination of a bear into a mythology about a wolf would have been confusing. And if the bear attacks Larry, now is he a werebear? What?
A care bear, werebear.
It's a second beat on the same note, which doesn't make any sense. Why does Larry have to protect another woman from another animal attack and stuff? I just think sharper minds prevailed. And you know what? You're right. I'm watching the film as we talk, and I'm just as seen in the gypsy camp. And you're right. Larry is there having a good time. He's smiling and looking around. Like you were right, Scott.
Yeah.
There's a gypsy lady dancing. Maybe that might have something to do with it.
Could be.
He's having a good time and stuff. Frank invites Larry to go do this like a little shooting range thing with BB guns or 22s or something. And they're shooting these little tin things. And And Larry proves that he's a pretty good shot and he can hit, you know, whatever he aims at. He's a capable guy until the image of a wolf pops up and he can't shoot it. And here's where we really see, obviously, Larry is traumatized by the things that happened.
And, right. And this is where you see some of the great, great facial acting of Cheney Jr. You know, you see it all the face, just that eyebrow, the eyebrows, you know, just everything. You see, when you're thinking of Larry Talbot, just looking anguished, this is it.
Just the very evident pain that exists inside him. Yeah, for sure. And then John Talbot and Mumford are sort of watching from the distance in there, and creepy. they see him have his thing, and he's like, he's overstressed. He's just,
there's a lot of people on the outskirts just watching Larry, like Osmond Sky is somewhere, Marleva is you know watching him, and then you get Sir John, and you know, it's like, and they just like spying on this poor guy.
Yeah, and everyone has their own concerns and possibly motivations for that. I mean, you know, you keep thinking John is looking at his potential heir and he's like, oh, what if this guy can't? What if this guy's not capable of it? What if this once capable guy has had this experience now and now will not be able to, you know, do the job that's required of him?
And you know, Frank knows Sir John's watching. He's like, yeah, let's go be friends with Larry. If Larry was not a Talbot, there's no friggin' way he's going over and say it. Oh, I'm not the jealous type.
You have an interesting take on Frank Andrews. Next time I watch this movie, I will probably watch it with that in mind. Like, is Frank just like maneuvering himself?
Totally. Oh my God. He's trying to save his job. And
yeah,
you know, he's brown nosing with the Talbot.
It worked on me, I guess, because I was just thinking, oh, he's actually a really nice guy.
Yeah, maybe he is. I don't know.
Turns out he's just looking for a thing. So after Larry's, you know, kind of flashback incident or whatever have you, at the thing, he goes and he tries to walk away and he runs into Maliva, and you have this amazing scene between Lon Chaney Jr. and Maria Ospenskaya, who, as I said before, with the Lon Chaney and Claude Rains scene, Lon Chaney Jr. and Maria Ospenskaya have this amazing rapport there's a maternal thing going on there, obviously, totally. That she has for him. She has a feeling of responsibility because her son is the one who put him in this situation. She is bringing all this ancient mythology and legend to him that he's not prepared for. He's dealing with his own trauma. And now she, on top of this, she's like, oh, by the way, you're a werewolf. You're going to kill the person you love most. And yeah, all this other bad. She's just bringing a lot of bad news to Larry.
She's bringing a lot of bad news and she's kind of stating it. But there's a sense of love and tragedy in her voice and her face. Yes. Again, just wonderful acting.
Yes.
And I'm so happy. I mean, Frank will go on to Frankenstein Meets Wolfman. Yeah, obviously a film that has its flaws. But I mean, one of the strongest, if not the strongest aspects of that film is this continuation of the relationship between Maliva,
mother-son relationship.
Talbot. It is it's great stuff.
And you talk about the height difference. He's like a foot and a half taller than Maria Ospenskaya. I mean, she's literally like the size of his leg. It's the funniest thing. and it's just a darling kind of thing. It's wrought with tragedy too. And Maliva, the gypsy woman, knows what Larry Talbot's fate is going to be already. There's not a doubt in her mind. She's hoping to maybe navigate him, I think, through it with at least pain as possible, but she knows he's cursed now and so she knows the sooner he embraces that, the better it'll be for everybody.
Yeah. So right after the scene, so they kind of, you know, she kind of informs him what's going on. He's, you know, now it's starting to inch into his mind that, you know, maybe this, you know, I am cursed. And then, you know, he runs off and then she, you know, kind of goes around to the rest of the fortune teller carnival and kind of, you know, whispers to everyone, basically saying, hey, there's a werewolf in town. But to her credit, and I'd kind of forgotten about this, she doesn't leave with them. She sticks around. Everyone else takes off and leaves.
She gets her people out of the danger zone, right? Yeah, that's true. That's an interesting thing. I never thought about that.
She sticks around. And again, she's going to shepherd Larry. I mean, as easier it would have been for her just to stay with her crew here and move on to the next town. She does not do that.
She feels a sense of responsibility.
And, that's right.
And there's a nobility in her that's what it is. There's this tragic nobility in all these characters, in John Talbot Sr., in Larry, and in Maliva. They all have a sense of moral responsibility. They have a very, very hardly built code that makes you just respect every one of them. There's not a sketchy, skeegy character in the whole.
No,
you know, you can not like Paul Mumford, but he's a man of his convictions and he's committed to them.
No, and they don't have too many scenes. I mean, maybe just the one scene together, but with Maliva and Sir John right at the end, just you know, when Sir John almost has that, you know, has that epiphany, like, holy crap.
Incredible.
Just a great scene. Just two amazing actors with just, you know.
Yeah. The skill assembled for this ensemble is always the more I watch it, the more I appreciate it.
It might be the best as far as talent goes. When you put sheer talent on screen, this might be the best.
It's like an amazing stage play you're watching. Everyone, these scenes are just amazing. So she sounds the alarm, and all the fortune tellers GTFO. And again, as you said, we find out later that she has stayed. Larry kind of runs off as is his wont, and has like kind of an episode where we have a lot of cool superimpositions, and we see Gwen Conliff's face, we see the pentagram, we see the wolf, we see. A lot of stuff that doesn't even factor in the film, and I don't know if it's extra footage they shot or stock stuff they had or what. They kind of throw everything in the lens at this point to very much epitomize the mental state of, you know, Larry's breakdown and stuff. Yeah,
right. And it's the eve of his first transformation. So,
right.
Yeah. I mean, this is literally his mind probably, you know, succumbing to this curse. But yeah, it's a cool little scene of, like you said, every amulet, everything that was brought up before about, you know, werewolfery is now, you know, in this little fever dream.
Yeah, he exits. So after the fever dream, he goes back to Talbot Castle. He goes in his room, and we see, you know, this kind of, we know he's not feeling right. We know there's something going on. He takes his socks and shoes off and rolls up his pant legs. And there's definitely a inappropriate amount of hair growth going on down there. Something's not right.
Instant puberty in Larry Talbot. Yeah.
And the funny thing, so right before this, he had, you know, he gives Gwen the amulet, right? He wants her to have it and stuff like that, because he's already thinking like maybe she's not safe and whatnot. So the interesting thing, and I'll cut forward a little bit, the interesting about this film is we actually don't see a real transformation scene until the end of the film. These first three incidents of him turning into the Wolfman all happen kind of off screen, or we see sort of a kind of a thing, and we associate the transformation scene so much with this film, and it's like Dracula changing into a bat. Like Lugosi never turns into the bat in Dracula,
right?
That's only the later films and stuff like that. So it's only the latter ones where we get in Frankenstein versus Wolfman, House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula, where you have these actual transformations.
And you think Werewolf of London, 6 years before this, had an amazing transformation. You think of Howl Walking, and we covered it left to right, and they kind of going behind those pillars. And every time he would reappear, he's a little more transformed. But
But you know, but you know that this was a newer technique, this way they were going to do him transforming, which we'll get into in a bit, the stop dissolve kind of process. And I don't think it was a cheap decision. I don't think it was like a budgetary decision. I think it was a dramatic decision. I think it was a decision to hold off on that reveal until the end of the film. So I think it's I'm all about any transformation scene into a werewolf I can see, you know, hey, I think it's a smart, George Winer's really a filmmaker.
He only had so many tricks in the box, right? So you don't want to just reveal everything. And then you
don't give it away all the way. Yeah.
Right.
And it's a neat idea that it'll come right at the end.
Yeah.
So we don't see it because we go straight from his legs transforming to, as you said, is that iconic shot of we see werewolf feet walking through the fog from left to right across camera. And we see a very unfortunate gravedigger.
Yeah. So really Larry Wolfman, the first victim. So he's, you know, kind of hanging out, digging his grave, and looks up and sees from a distance. You can kind of hear like the growling and the howling. He's like, oh, what the hell is that? And then, you know, Larry kind of, or, you know, Wolfman Larry gets closer and closer, and just some great facial expressions of this grave digger, like, oh shit. Like,
yeah.
I'm in trouble. He drops him pretty damn quickly. And then it's really a quick scene back into the Talbot estate in Larry's bedroom where he's waking up for the first time. And, you know, he's got the dirty feet and there's wolf footprints all over the bedroom. And, you know, the windowsill, there's dirt all over the place. So at this point, you know, there's no question in Larry's mind. He knows what's either he's going insane or he's, you know, he is truly, you know, the Wolfman, I guess.
So Larry wakes up and he's kind of, you know, he's blacked out from the night before, and it's not to whatever. It's probably something, the idea of waking up from a blackout is something that Lon Chaney Jr. probably was. and I don't say that to be mean. There is this idea that, and we talked about this in House of Dracula episode as well, that There's an overlap between Larry Talbot and Lon Chaney. There's this character who is the son of a well-respected person, as you know, Lon Chaney Sr. was, a son who kind of exists in the shadow of that, as Lon Chaney Jr. did. And then there is this terrible tragedy, right? And I don't want to paint Lon Chaney Jr.'s life as a tragedy, because he lived a long life and he was quite successful for part of it. And he, for someone who I think the common myth or whatever is that he existed in the shadow of his father. I would argue that now I think more people are probably familiar with Lon Chaney Jr. than they are Lon Chaney Sr., wouldn't you?
100%. I mean, my parents, just to give an example, I mean, they're not huge, huge horror fans.
Yeah.
And they had no idea. I was, you know, talking to them today that we were doing The Wolfman and Lon Chaney Jr. They had no idea Lon Chaney Sr., even what movies he was in. Like, my dad knew Jr. He even said himself, Mice and Men, and some other film. But I had to tell him he was the Phantom of the Opera and, you know, Man of a Thousand Faces. So I guess just, you know, in pop culture, it's Chaney Jr.
I mean, High Noon and you know, everything. I mean, he really was I would argue he ended up eclipsing his father's. I mean, his father's legacy is important and critical, and I'm a huge Lon Chaney Sr. fan, and I don't want anyone to misunderstand that. But back to my thing is that there's a bit of a tragic overlap between the character and the actor. Yes, is it what makes Larry Talbot so compelling? Partially, maybe that and Lon Chaney's actual just, you know, skill as an actor, obviously. But. It's an investment. That overlap of the Venn diagram of the actor and the character brings the peak of, you know, tragedy to this story. Anyway,
yeah, really does. Yeah. So Larry wakes up and, you know, pretty much understands that, you know, that transformation has happened. And meanwhile, Paul Mumford, who's, you know, I've seen him listed as Colonel. I think he's Captain Mumford of, you know, the village police force.
I think they refer to him as a few different things in the movie.
Yeah.
I hear him called Captain. I hear him called like Commander as well. Yeah. And so, and maybe that is correct within that nomenclature of that, whatever, you know, constabulary or something like that.
But, call him Paul Mumford, whoever the chief police.
Well,
the
Paul.
Chief police dude discovers the body of this gravedigger, and then follows. So it's Paul Mumford finds, of course, wolf tracks all around the body of the gravedigger, follows them out. And of course, the tracks lead back to Chaney Manor. So Larry is, you know, kind of coming up from this, you know, again, this fever dream. And, you know, he's kind of covering up the evidence and there's dirt all over the window. So he's pushing it out and sees Paul, his old buddy, coming, you know, kind of creeping up to the house, following these tracks. And Larry, you know, at one point, Larry, like, you know, jumps behind the window and he's kind of peeking out like, you know, holy crap. So,
I mean, every bit of evidence leads to Larry,
right? At this point,
as the killer, except for the fact that they're wolf tracks, and especially someone with a didactic mind like Paul Mumford would never make that logical jump. Like, oh well, Larry must be the wolf. You know, it's outside his own, you know, whatever, you know, concept. But Larry wakes up, and he looks and he sees the 5-pointed star scar on his chest, which this movie's a remarkable achievement of makeup and Jack Pierce's part. That crayon drawn scar on Larry's chest is possibly not the best example of his makeup ability. I'm not sure. I don't think you could really show like a keloided, really gnarly kind of scar. Probably you could show a guy turning into a wolf, but somehow you couldn't show like gashes and blood and anything, you know, the smacked of gore in 1941. So I think that's was sort of a concession more than anything else, possibly.
I think we're going to pretend that was like a Pierce, maybe assistant or, you know.
Yeah, it very possibly might not even be Lon Chaney Jr.'s chest. That could have been like a stand-in and stuff. That could be an insert they shot. But Larry definitely now, I mean, he's seen the wolf prints. He's seen the mud. He probably has some vague recollection of what happened, even though they have to explain to him what happened. And he's now absolutely convinced that he turns into a wolf and he is responsible for the murder. And he needs to probably leave town before he hurts anybody else.
Sure. No. And that leads us right up to a really great scene. So he goes downstairs, obviously gets dressed, and it's, you know, Sunday. So they're ready to go to church. So he goes downstairs and sees his dad, Sir John, and has a very, you know, open and out without giving away the, you know, the whole bag of groceries. Basically, it's like, you know, his dad is an extremely smart man. So that's picking his brain a little bit, like, Dad, tell me everything you need to know, or tell me everything you know about, you know, werewolves and, you know,
no reason or all, just, you know,
right. Small talk. it's Church Sunday, so let's talk about werewolves and pentagrams and blah, 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 blah. And it's just a really nice scene. Again, just some great acting between two great actors.
And Sir John breaks it down into the idea of the duality of man, the good and evil. And that's what I think that does fall into a lot of traditional mythologies about lycanthropy and beast creature, beast men and beast women. The idea that the animal is a meaner, crueler, less evolved, obviously, version of us, and to embrace that side of you. It's like Vikings who would do the berserker thing where they would become like bear type creatures and stuff. They would imagine they were bear type creatures and they'd go crazy and they'd go on the battlefield and you know, lay waste and stuff. It's this idea of like that. I think that, you know, for me, I think the werewolf in modern pop culture, I think it represents like inevitability of change. I think the idea that there are things we don't have control over, you know, in ourselves, in our world, urges we don't want to have, the loss of, you know, like, you know, autonomy. It's like the loss of self-control. And I think that kind of terrifies us. And this idea of going into this fugue state where you're capable of doing all these awful atrocity things, without meaning to it hits home. And whether it means you turn into a wolf and grow hair, or whether it means you just go into this other, there's the idea that there's this other version of you lurking inside that is capable of things that you're not, is really terrifying. And I think, again, it's like there's reasons this film is as famous as it is, and other films that are made just as well in the era are not. It's because it hit a note in an audience's mind.
Yeah, I mean, even to this day, I mean, yeah, Larry is more trying to, you know, get his dad to at least tell him, you know, is it possible that a man literally could physically change into a wolf?
Right.
And Sir John's like, well, no, it's fantastic. That's, you know, of course that couldn't happen, but anything could happen. I think in the mind.
He tells him that, and the doctor tells him that too. And that's right. That's Larry's struggle, is like, is what's happening to me really happening, or am I going crazy?
It's just ambiguity. And it's like, you got to wonder at this point, like, when did the screenwriters determine? It might have even happened after filming was done and they just edited it a certain way.
You wonder if some of this was written in the edit, as they say. No, sure. Absolutely. But it works because, you know, even the word lunatic is based on loon, which is the moon.
The lunatic.
And the idea that the full moon would drive people crazy. So it goes hand in hand, this idea of like losing your mind or, you know, becoming the wolf and stuff. And there's a great scene here where Larry, you know, they go to church and Larry, you know, takes a few steps in and stops in the back of the church and just freezes. And everyone in the entire church turns and stares at him, and he can't go down. He can't walk to and his dad is sitting in the very front row, of course, because he's the Lord. And, you know, Mumford and the doctor and everybody turned to stare at him, and Gwen, we all know that feeling, right?
Oh, I mean, Gwen's looking at him, Gwen's dad's looking at him, you know, the spinster women, you know, they're all kind of, you know, what is going on with this guy? And kind of
finally
a cool fact,
dad turns.
Kind of a cool fact, Jim, and something we always have to throw in here. So that scene, or that church scene, I guess, was taken, there's some set designs actually from The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the 23 Chaney film, the Chaney Senior.
Was it? I wanted to look that up, and I didn't really have time and stuff. So that's amazing. I'm not surprised at that at all. It looks very, very much like in it could have been Notre Dame and stuff. It's a great,
exactly,
because you're like, well, they didn't build that just for that one little scene. I mean, that would be irresponsible. So I love the idea that
that's a beautiful set piece. And yeah, it was a set that, you know, his dad was on, you know, 20 or God.
Yeah. What a weird circularity. That's interesting. Yeah. So afterwards, you know, there's this little scene in back at the estate where Mumford and Frank,
Lloyd, Frank, yeah.
Yeah. And the doctor are there, and it's, there's this whole idea of like, I mean, Larry almost goes for Mumford at one point, and his dad holds him back, you know?
Yep. He does. He's like, yeah, anything, you know, anyone that believes that they're, again, Larry's just grasping at straws, man. He is just like, please help me. Like, and he doesn't even understand what's going on. And yeah, Mumford's like, oh, anyone that's, you know, a lunatic like that belongs in an asylum.
An asylum for them. Oh, chomp on my pipe kind of guy.
Larry kind of jumps off, and, you know, luckily Sir John's like, hey, chill out.
Like, don't do it. Yeah. And Sir John knows his son well enough that he knows what's about to happen. He can sense it. He's very in touch. I think you can look at this film as a metaphor for mental illness and the stigma of it, and the amount of people who probably need help and somehow can't get it, you know, because that's like, Larry is just, he wants help. He really is looking for help, and he can't navigate through all the different opinions of the people around him and find his own way. You know, John, Mumford, Maliva, Gwen, the doctor, you know, whose name I can never remember from.
Lloyd. Yeah. But no, it's true. Like, he's surrounded by all these learned men and men too. And all he's not simple-minded, but you know, he's hands-on, you know, whatever. But he's surrounded by Sir John and Dr. Lloyd, all these folks that should at some point,
He says it like, he's like, I want something I can touch and fix.
Right.
Yeah. And all this esoteric stuff is really messing with them.
I know.
The main thing that's going on here, really, that's causing some issues is that you know, the entire village thinks there's this wolf still around that's killing people, and they're very focused on that, which is appropriate, you know. So no one really totally has all the time in the world to deal with what Larry's going through. They're focused on what they feel like is the more important issue, is to protect people from an animal that is dangerous.
Well, and certainly Sir John, because I mean, John obviously wants to take care of his adults. I preface that adult son. I mean, he says a couple of different times, Larry, you're not a child anymore, so you can't be listening to gypsies and blah, blah, blah. But John has responsibility as the Lord.
Yeah.
No, as the Lord of this village to take care of his people.
There's something out there. I've got to be there with my people. Exactly. Yeah, he has obligations. He takes those things seriously.
That's right.
Yeah, again, and Larry just the odd man out in every situation, and I don't feel like that's maybe too far away from the way Lon Jr. felt sometimes. Sure. You know, Lon was born Creighton Chaney, and you know, the son of is the famous Lon Chaney Sr. While he was still doing stage work, performing and stuff, his mom attempted suicide when he was very young. She tried to drink like acid on stage. She was a singer and a great singer, apparently. She drank acid and didn't die, but it destroyed her voice. So it destroyed her career. His father divorced her. I think she was committed at some point. Mm-hmm. She obviously dealt with her own mental challenges.
Died very young.
So Lon himself comes out of tragedy. Doesn't immediately go for a career in film. You know, he'd worked in many other types of jobs for a long time. There are people who are probably much more learned in Chaney family history than I. But I do think around the time his dad passed away from throat cancer or esophageal cancer, I think Lon was merging back into work doing film. And at some point, someone convinced, and I've heard different stories about this guy, maybe you have a better story version of it. Someone convinced him to drop his actual name and adopt Lon Chaney Jr. as his stage name.
Yeah. I mean, Jim, right around this time, I mean, from what I understand, I mean, he's newly married. He might have even had a child at the time and was not successful, was not a successful actor. I mean, did okay. But again, now he had, mouths to feed. He needed a roof over his head and, you know, to put money and to put food on the table. Yeah, they said, you know, we'll give you work, Creighton, but, now you're Lon Chaney Jr.
You got to build yourself with this, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of, so going back and, looking at this film again, I thought, I mean, I remember in later films, they marked him as Lon Chaney. And I thought film here was Junior, but he's Chaney in this. He's not Junior.
He's just Chaney. Yeah. He's not. Yeah. I mean, technically he's not. Yeah. I mean, his father's, passed and stuff, but, he's 35, right? In this. Yeah. I think he's 35 when he does this film. So he's he's a man and he's now as you said, like he's got responsibilities. He's got a child or something like that. He's got a dog, right?
Begrudgingly did not want to do it. He did not want to follow on his, riding on his dad's coattails. But I think, hey, the world's a harsh place and nobody was putting, right off the depression and everything. And
he made that concession. And I don't know if he privately still went by Creighton or if his friends called him Lon or not. I've never gotten to meet anybody who worked with him. I've met a few people who've worked with other folks, but never him. But it's interesting.
So we're going. As Larry was about to attack Paul Mumford for, a lunatic's belonging in an asylum, it was Dr. Lloyd who, was kind of more of the calming influence saying, people with mental illness need to be understood. They need to be helped. And that calms Larry down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And as Larry, Dr. Lloyd and Larry are having this great conversation, it's Frank, the gameskeeper, saying, well, I'm going to go and set some traps. I'm going to catch this friggin' wolf. And of course, Paul Mumford's like, oh shit, I'm coming with you. Then let's go catch this thing.
Right.
They start setting traps around the woods and everything, which seems extremely unsafe if people are just, off walking around with their loved ones
It does seem like, well, now the carnival's gone, maybe less people are wandering around.
A little irresponsible, but they start setting like bear traps all around this woods.
And you know, Larry and you know, the doctor having this, you know, nice little conversation kind of calms Larry down a bit. And yeah, so right after they have a discussion, he wants to talk to the doctor more. And the doctor basically says, hey, Larry, go rest. And it's funny, you hear this a lot with, like, again, with 1930s, 1940s, it's always like, usually with the women, like, oh, you're hysterical. Go lay down for the day. Go rest for the day. I'll talk to you in the morning. And the doctor, Lloyd, kind of does the same thing with Larry. Says, just go away. Go take a nap. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
They do treat him like a child. And it's weird. So. Like, he's not a child. He's a very capable.
He's a grown man. And he's, the heir to the estate. But sends him away. And then, of course, you know, Paul and Frank are out setting traps. And then the next scene, no transformation scene. It's the Wolfman in the woods here and gets caught in a trap.
Right. He's out wandering and stuff. Caught in the trap, and who should show up again? But
Maria Osmanskaya
the gypsy woman.
Yeah. So he gets caught in the trap, and then rather than rustling around, it brings me back to Frankenstein meets. No, I'm sorry. House of Dracula, where he gets stuck in the jail, and rather than like fighting and trying to tear down the bars, he just kind of faints or just falls down. Does the same thing here. He gets stuck in the bear trap or the wolf trap, and just kind of passes out. And then Maliva the fortune teller comes and says, you know, the way you walk was thorny, and transforms back to Larry human form, and becomes conscious again and is able to get himself out of the trap.
Yeah,
and
because the huntsmen are coming. You can hear them. Right. They have dogs and everything. You know, they're coming, and they're gonna see him. Lunching does this amazing thing when he gets caught in the trap. There's a scene where, you know, he's walking and he's got the trap on him, and he's dancing around and he's in pain.
Yeah,
and he just does this crazy thing that I'm amazed didn't turn into like a big dance in the 60s or something. The Wolfman in a trap, because he's hopping and doing a thing, but he's trying to, you know, still be the animal thing. And I don't know why. It cracks me the hell up.
Oh, Chuck Berry, my God. Chubby Checker had the twist. We shouldn't launch any,
Wolfman in a trap. Totally. Yeah. Maria Osmanskaya comes, and she does this, this chant thing, which again, it is like a blessing. It does
just calms give the beast.
Peace for a moment.
Yeah. So it becomes conscious and gets himself out of the trap and starts walking away. And two of the hunters, they kind of spot Larry. They don't see him by the face. They kind of see him from behind, and they're yelling at him, saying, you know, hey, who are you? Come back. And they see it's Sir John, you know, the heir to the Talbot Estate.
Sir Larry. Yeah.
But Sir Larry, you know, and which is kind of odd. And then Paul Mumford, of course, is right behind, and, you know, who the hell was that? And he's like, oh, it's, you know, Sir Larry. And
Sir Larry,
sir, and takes a mental note, like, oh, geez.
And John and Mumford's like, that's weird. Mm-hmm. You know, he does, you know, Larry does, he covers. They're like, what are you doing out here? He's like, well, same thing as you. What are you talking about? Like, he challenges that they would even challenge him. You know, I mean, he pulls the son of the Lord card just for a second there, you know. He's limping and he's barefoot and
And this is when then he goes right to Gwen's shop. So he kind of is outside of her window, and at this point it's probably midnight, so it's, you know, she's asleep in bed, so it starts picking up little pebbles trying to wake her up, which she ultimately does. She comes down and lets him in and basically says, you know, Gwen, I have to go away. You know, I'm in danger. I'm endangering you. I'm in danger to myself. I just need to go. And she's like full blown, I'm coming with you, Larry. Like, wait for me. I'm gonna go pack a bag. This Frank guy must not be all that, because she's like ready to just leave with Larry Talbot.
You get the feeling maybe their families were friends or something.
Maybe an arranged marriage.
Not an arranged, but it was maybe, you know what? Honestly, it's a small town, and there's probably not a whole lot of options. And Patrick Knowles is a decent looking guy. You know, he's got all his hair, you know, whatever. But then Larry comes along, and now there's an option, and that's different. And there's also, I think, Gwen is attracted to the tragedy of him as well. You know, Larry Talbot is tragic before he gets bit by the wolf. I mean, his brother dies, you know, tragically. You know, he is, again, obviously this, you know, outsider and stuff. I just think Gwen has a mixed sympathy and adoration for him that's interesting to, you know, their dynamic is really neat. And we've talked about Evelyn Anchors' skills and beauty before, obviously on the podcast. And you know, she's spectacular. There's a great moment. It happens. I wrote it down. It's about 58 minutes into the film, where Larry's outside the antique store and he's throwing pebbles at the thing. I think it's Frank Skinner did the music for this. This is This film also, by the way, ushers in the music for this, for Wolfman, is used for the next 10 years copiously for another, you know, all the other Universal films. The Skinner score, I'm pretty sure it's Frank Skinner. Is just recycled and recycled and recycled. And you hear it in Horror Island and
all those mummy
and
films.
Everything. Yeah. All of them, yeah. But there's a moment here at 58 minutes where he's thrown it. Everybody, if you go listen to that, tell me it is not Danny Elfman's main title theme for the Batman. Da, 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 da. It is literally, wow. I mean, I'm not saying Danny Elfman stole it. I'm just saying, you know, there's X amount of notes in the world and there's only so many ways they can go together, but it is absolutely, it's reused in Horror Island as well early on in the film too, but it's just a funny little note. I remember watching this time. It's like, that is the theme to Batman. Hang on a second.
So Danny Elfman's lawyers, if you're listening to that, that was Jim Towns that said that, not Scott Kelly.
I'm not claiming he stole it. There are a certain amount of notes and only so many ways they can go together.
There's really similar. No, Jim, that's a wonderful point. There's definitely similarities. And
John Williams' Superman theme sounds a heck of a lot like the Fleischer cartoon Superman music. I'm just saying, you know, things quote in a similar way. I like Larry's disheveled look here where his hair is down.
Yeah.
And you know, he's kind of whatever. He gets started looking a little bit like man-made monster. So in this scene,
totally,
you know,
yeah.
He's pleading with Gwen. And he sees the pentagram appear in the palm of her hands, which by the way, is a really neat effect. I'm sure that's done with like a little light and a gobo in a close up. I don't know if that's actually Evelyn Anker's hand, even. It might be a double. Yeah. Anyway.
But to your point, Jim, before we leave the shop here, just some great, great acting by Chaney. I mean, he is absolutely unglued at this point.
He's unraveling.
Like I said, just the hair is totally disheveled.
Yeah.
Just a great, great piece of acting.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the next scene here on the stairs with his dad, I'm not sure what I'm sure it was the, Vera West is always credited as, you know, the gowns by Universal films.
Yeah.
I'm not sure who dressed the men in Universal films who obviously didn't wear gowns. But obviously, I mean, the men's fashions in these movies are fantastic and, you know, great of the period. Larry always wears this double-breasted suit. Except for, I think there's one where he wears like a tweedy kind of thing, but he wears this dark suit with usually almost always a dark collared shirt, which goes for when you'll notice like the Wolfman never turns and he's wearing a white dress shirt the way a normal, you know, typical white dress shirt that men would wear around this period. For some reason, there was a decision made that he always wear a dark gray or brown or
gray,
charcoal.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, whatever color it really was in real life and not in black and white. And I don't know if that worked better for exposure, probably, because his face was dark. I want to say, like, if they exposed for his face, they might have blown out his shirt in some of these darker night scenes and stuff, because he's got all the brown makeup and the fur and everything.
Yeah, good point.
But it also makes Larry dresses differently from everyone else in the town. No one, he dresses more like a 30s, 40s American guy, you know, a New Yorker kind of guy.
Yeah,
and everyone else has these more like conservative knits and ties and stuff like that. It's just an interesting thing.
He's like Al Capone.
It makes him broad too. It makes him huge too. He's like,
I know when I was looking at some of the like the flubs of the movie, I think someone had an issue with, I think it was that first transformation, that whatever colored shirt. I don't think it wasn't overly egregious, but
he strips down to his white tank top, and then he does apparently put on a dark button-up shirt before he turns into the werewolf. I know, but
it's not like Hollywood, like he puts on like
his
Cali cap and the vest
but can you imagine how much of a pain in the butt it would have been to make up his entire shoulders and arms and everything, and somehow they're still working on it at this point. But yeah, he goes home from Gwen's house or Gwen's, you know, whatever apartments and the antique store. Puts on a suit now because he's leaving town. He can't do this anymore. He knows that he will kill Gwen, and he can't do that, obviously, because he's absolutely, and you know, Gwen probably is enamored of him. Larry is full on in love with Gwen. It's obvious, and you know, from the start. And he and Sir John have this confrontation on the stairs, which is again this dignity that Claude Rains brings to this film. You can't underestimate it, or you can't overstate it, I should say. He's like, do you think someone is going to come into this house and take you, Larry? You're the son of, you know, you're a Talbot and stuff.
From this point on, and we'll see a couple of, you know, some others. This is truly father and son. This isn't like Lord and, you know, Lord Junior. This is, I mean, he calls him dad. you know, sir,
I was going to say he doesn't do it until right at the end.
Yeah. It's always like, sir, you know,
it's the American side of him. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So John's only hope at this point is he thinks he needs Larry to see that this is all in his mind, and maybe that will cure him of this mental kind of thing he's got himself stuck in. So he's going to tie him to a chair, leave the window open, and let Larry watch the hunt for the wolf that's going to happen tonight from through the window. We can call it tough love, you know, okay. But John can't stay there. John has to be out there with his people trying to protect them and stuff. That's his place. Your place is here.
That's right. No, he says that to his son. He's like, Larry, this is your fight. I think Larry at one point is like, you know, Dad, aren't you going to stay with me? Like, Larry, I've got responsibilities here. Like, my village is under attack by this wolf. Like, you need to settle this on your own.
Yeah.
And, you know, leaves. And to your point, tough love, you know, ties Larry up to this chair and goes to this, you know, this hunting scene. And this is really kind of the third final act of the movie inside in the woods, and everyone's on this like platform, and they've got the torches and the rifles. And
I also think that Sir John still 95% is convinced this is a wolf doing this. And he thinks that if they can catch or kill the wolf, it'll show Larry that he's not responsible for this. You know, I mean, to some degree, that also is his solution to cure his son, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you're saying 95%, it's probably right. And then, but I'm going back thinking of, you know, a little bit further on the movie. I mean, we're out in the last 5 minutes. Goes to the hunting stage and sees Frank and Paul, but then returns back to the house and runs into Maliva. And Maliva even questions him, like, you know, Sir John, why aren't you at the hunting booth? And he's like,
it's these last 10 minutes that his faith in science is starting to get upended as well. And he's moving towards the center.
Yes.
Closer to where Maliva exists.
That's right.
And that's sort of John. That's the tragedy of John Talbot, I guess, in the story too. Like, you know, it's a story about Larry Talbot, but there's a through story about John Talbot too, about this man of science who learns too late that there, you know, I always say like the Shakespeare quote, there's more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in his philosophies. And he learns it too late. He only learns it through the death of his son. And we learn that, you know, in Frankenstein versus Wolfman, that he basically dies of grief after,
yes, you
know, soon after the end of this film, after you know, spoilers, clubbing his son to death with a cane.
I mean, you want a class in acting, guys? I mean, Claude Rains, I mean, amazing voice. I mean, The Invisible Man, you don't even see Claude until the very, very end, just his voice acting.
Yeah.
But just the facial acting, the body language of Rains from this point on, when he meets Maliva to the very end, we'll get there when he clubs, you know, Cheney Jr. This is masterful work. Rains is off the charts. Great here.
Yeah. You could have put someone else in this role, and I don't think this movie fires on all the cylinders it does. This is it's his kind of thing. And again, you know, Claude Rains coming from a very poor part of England and having a very thick British accent and having to sort of relearn how to speak and relocate his accent into this more formal dialect that we associate with him for everything. But you know, he came from the sticks. And speaking of sticks, there's this great moment here where right at the end Larry says, Dad, take the cane.
Right.
And when you play that out to the its end result, the tragedy of that one line just gives you chills. It's
just take the stick. He's like begrudgingly, he's like, I'll take the stick. It wasn't like he just like threw it, you know, off to the side and left the house without it. He brought it with him.
Okay. Yeah. He takes it with him. So all the guys are up in this little hunting thing, which is like 4 feet off the ground. So I'm not sure how that's going to protect them from a wolf, but okay. They're still worried about, you know, John's there worried about his son, the doctor's, you know, up there with Mumford and stuff. And John decides like, I'm going to go back and check on him. John is starting to second guess himself. I think he's second guessing everything, you know, that he believes, and he's starting to wonder if he shouldn't trust his son better. There's amazing shots in this final bit of this forest.
There is.
And the shrouded was get out of here.
And I kind of wish there was a little something else. Like, I mean, being Sir John, I mean, obviously very, you know, very learned and intelligent guy. I wish there was something like not even a clue, but something that might have pushed him over the edge to say, shit, I wonder if I'm wrong. He seems to come to it very quickly. He's at the hunting booth.
Yeah.
I just wish there was something, maybe something Larry said before he left, just little something, like a little pebble that make John or Sir John
some little bit of like actual evidence, maybe.
Right.
But I think his movement is about him, like, I guess, surrendering the staunchness of his beliefs. And
sure,
what you do end up with is this amazing interaction, because they haven't met at all yet in the film. And finally, here at the end of the movie, he's wandering and he runs into Maliva, who's just, you know, hanging out, waiting for what's going to happen. It's going to happen, because I think she knows it.
Sure.
She is a fortune teller. So if she's not presciently aware of what's going to happen, I think she can read the cards. Right. And then they have this meeting of a minds where the cold logic of John's worldview runs into her belief in myth and legend. And she's taunting him. She's the only person who's not she's not respectful for him, but she doesn't acquiesce to him.
Taunting's the right word. Yeah.
She's like, are you going somewhere, Sir John? Are you worried about your son? Are you really worried that what he's saying to you or whatever? She's messing with him because, you know, she knows she's right. She knows she's seen the wolf. She's seen him turn into the wolf. She knows he's a werewolf and stuff. And I guess she understands that really the main problem is that no one else is taking this problem seriously.
And you can, I mean, just even the choice of words. I mean, again, you know, Sir John, a very dignified, you know, classy man. And he's like, oh, you know, these witches' tales. Like, he kind of cuts, you know, it's kind of hitting below the belt a little bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he's very dismissive of her. Like, you're the one who's been filling this.
Well, I mean,
like,
very disrespectful, but at the same time, is he just trying to convince himself now as he's having doubts? Like, if I'm
exactly, yeah.
I think that's what it is. Like, he's almost all these stupid witches' tales. I mean, who are you trying to convince, Maliva or yourself? And obviously,
He's like, I'm not some fool. Like, I'm
right, right.
Exactly. But nevertheless, she gets to him. You know, she gets under his skin.
She does, and he's, you know, by all accounts, ready to turn back to go back to the house. Mm-hmm. And you know, Wolfman makes his final appearance in the woods, and you know, comes after and attacks Gwen.
Larry has, I guess, gone out of the ropes. I'm not sure how that happens, and if the film has one kind of plot failing, I wish there'd been some kind of something. Maybe something was filmed and it was decided not to have it or something.
It kind of brought me back to like Frankenstein Wolfman, where he's in the straitjacket. He's like, well, how the hell do you get out of a straitjacket with this?
They say in Frankenstein, it was a bit right through a straitjacket.
Yeah, with his teeth.
Bit right through a straitjacket. Oi.
Like, how the hell do you get through out of a straitjacket? He's like, with his teeth? So you gotta, you know, maybe when he turned, he went, you know, full werewolf.
There's at least like a throwaway line there.
Yeah. Torn off. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but here we have this, I mean, very iconic final scene of Gwen's running through the woods, trying to find Larry. I guess she thinks he's part of the hunt. I would assume. And she runs into Maliva. Maliva's like, get the F out of here. What are you doing? There's guys hunting with guns and there's probably a werewolf. You dumb, silly girl. Right. I mean,
go back to the antique shop.
Yeah. What are you doing? And so she's running and she's not dressed very practically. She's wearing heels in the woods and stuff, but you know, what else is she gonna do? And the wolfman is stalking her, and you see this you know, she's unaware, and you just see him like trotting behind her, and it's not like he's so now, like, you know, he's chasing her, Sir John is chasing him, and the guys with torches are converging and stuff. So there's this amazing dramatic bit of you know, this everything comes together until she finally stops, and you have this amazing shot where he walks up in this close up, and she knows he's going to kill her, and it's just horrifying.
Grabs her, and man, he's really shaking her, and you know, ultimately kind of throws her down. You know, doesn't kill her, but puts her down. And this is the point, and you know, going back to real life for a second, where Evelyn Anker is passed out, so she was laying down at the end of the scene and passed out because of all the smoke, the gas in the smoke machine.
Really? Wow.
Almost died. Like, I think it was a stagehand that was walking around and tripped over her unconscious.
Oh my gosh. So she's like laying under the smoke and stuff.
Yeah, she was laying flat under the smoke. No one knew where she was. And there was a stagehand doing, I don't know, maybe setting up the next scene, and tripped over her. So luckily they found her unconscious and got her the hell out of there, because she almost died from the smoke inhalation.
Yeah, because I believe, and now obviously with you know, modern filmmaking, we use different chemicals and things to create smoke, and they're much more benign. I think at this point they still would have been using a thing called AB smoke, which is like a two-part solution, which A, smelled terrible, and B, I think does sort of like leach oxygen a bit. So I wouldn't be surprised if a stage like this big, you'd have to start smoking it up hours before you film, and you have to keep the doors closed and everything, or else the minute you open that big door, like, you know, it's all gone. You have to start over again. You're going to lose hours, right? So you're kind of trapped in there. So I didn't know that story about her. That's amazing.
Yeah, really scary. But yeah, luckily they got her out of there in time. And then we had kind of the very final, scene between Sir John and Larry Wolfman. And as we know, Sir John has that silver cane and
yeah,
beats the wolf off. And it's kind of it's a tough, really tough, sad scene.
They kind of roll on the ground. It's more of a wrestling match than I remember. I always just remember him going up and clubbing him, but you know, he gets him in a chokehold and he's snarling at him. He just shillelaghs on him.
I was watching this closely and I rewound it a couple of times. I don't think they're using stunt doubles. Like, that looks like Claude Rains. I mean, there's a point where Chaney is on top of him and he kind of flips him on top.
Yeah,
and I was looking closely, I think it's Rains. I don't think there's any stunt doubles.
I'm watching it right now, and I think there's one shot towards the beginning of the fight. It's a wider shot where I do think it's a stunt double because the guy's hair looks a little different from Rains's. But I think it's Chaney all the way through. I don't think they made up a stunt double. I think Chaney, as far as I know, Chaney did most of his own stunts in all these films. I don't know if, I feel like there was maybe a double in Frankenstein versus Wolfman for some of those. He does some really high leaps.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's Chaney.
I'm sure towards the end.
He does one or two of those. And so when we get to that film, maybe by the time we get to the film, I'll have looked up some research or someone will have informed me
I think that's kind of one of the fun stories of that film was like most of like, I know like that whole final scene, like not like Chaney and Bella were not filming, like they were all stunt doubles.
We'll get there. There's definitely some stuff. Yeah. And ironic that the next time Lon Chaney and Bella do a Wolfman film together, Bella the gypsy is now playing the Frankenstein monster. It's a funny, again, it's like we have this ensemble that keeps just changing roles and roles every film.
Right.
But this is an amazing bit here right at the end. And he just, you know, just whacks the crap out of him. Maliva shows up just in time, obviously. And again, you know, kind of comes up to Larry. And you have the transformation scene. We've been waiting for an hour and something for this. And you have this amazing, beautiful thing. They would, you know, run the camera. They would like take a few frames and they would pause. Lon Chaney would get up. They would remove a little bit of the makeup. They might have done, this might be reversed. They might have actually started with him normal and made him up into the Wolfman and then played it backwards. I get the feeling. That seems like that would have been easier than doing the reverse. And so you end up with like, you know, there's a moment where you have Lon Chaney Jr. with kind of like Don King hair there at the end. He's still got the thing. They used Jack Pierce used yak hair for the wolf because it has this like, you know, heavy structure and doesn't look like normal human hair. And you would singe it at the end. So every time he would put on a little bit of that hair, he would glue it to Larry's face using spirit gum, which anyone who's used spirit gum, it's a pretty noxious material as well. It smells awful. It's very acrid and it doesn't come off your skin awfully easily. So it's actually pretty gnarly.
Not probably six hours, I think, to put the full makeup on, which is more than it's longer than even the Frankenstein monster.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a real process because it's like every time, because it's like he's got a film. For, you know, a shot, get up, go to wherever it is. And I'm sure they kept it pretty close by, but he has to go and do that. Come back, film a shot, get up, film a shot. And they would, as I've said before, they would figure out a little cradle or something for his head so that every time Lon would put his head down, it would hit the same exact, you know, mark and stuff. And I've seen some footage of they actually had a glass plate that would go down in front of the camera where they would draw a really precise outline of his face, like the position of his head.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they would move it out of the way to film. But then when he went back, they would slide that, I guess it was almost like a filter for the lens. They would slide it back in and the cinematographer could line up exactly like just the angle of his cheek and his nose and stuff. And you see, I think there's one or two transformations in the werewolf cycle of the next three films. The story of Larry Talbot that are almost maybe superior to this one, but as the first one, this one really, I'm sure someone in 1941 watched this and just went, what the hell did I just see? How on earth?
Of course.
Does somebody do that? It had almost nothing. If it had been done before, I don't know if it had been done to this quality. And it's really impressive.
Yeah. No, I mean, Frankenstein, Wolfman, they have some great, great transformations, but
yeah.
And again, this really is just going back to that, just that final scene, you know, you have Sir John looking over the body of, you know, also call him the Wolfman. He hasn't transformed at this point. So it's Sir John and it's Maliva. And then she starts, you know, the Way You Walk with Thorny chant. As you mentioned, Jim, the slow transformation back from, you know, he loses the facial hair, but has the Don King hair. And then you the expression of Claude Rains is just like the eyes. It's like,
growing horror when he realizes what he's done. And he also realizes that all the stuff he said to Larry, he was wrong. He should have trusted him a little more, maybe.
And you can understand why he would have died from grief. I mean, you learn this later on in the next one, but I mean, he just looks, I mean,
I mean, not only now he has nobody, obviously the mother is deceased. We never really hear about her, in the film, but then the brother and now his own son.
I mean, not only did he not believe his son, he just killed his son.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's responsible.
That's a pretty heavy load to carry.
It's very, you know, the story of the Wolfman is not, it's a real smart story, but it doesn't get bogged down in cleverness as much as it orbits around this mythic truth, this inevitability and this fate, these ideas that really just I think they resonate. And again, it's one of those, like I said, it's why, you know, Island of Lost Souls is an amazing film, but I would argue the less people know it as well as they know the story of the Wolfman. Wolfman is the thing that is now, it's like a modern pop culture myth. Like, people know the story of the Wolfman who've never seen the movie. It doesn't matter. They know, like, oh, another guy gets bit by the wolf and he turns into the werewolf, and, you know, I don't know.
I mean, as we learn more and more about mental illness, I mean, it just, gosh, this film is just so important and such a, you know, keynote for its time. I mean, every time I watch this film, it's like, this is why, and I, every time I throw it on, I'm like, well, let's see if it's still in my top three. Mm-hmm. It's like, hell yes. Every time I finish watching this film, I feel like I discover something else about it. It really, truly is such an important film on so many levels. I mean, just the acting. I'll go back and say it again. I think this might be, you know, the best ensemble of all the Universal films.
I would really argue that's true. And I also would say that this film takes itself so seriously. Without being corny, this film treats the story like it's a Shakespearean tragedy.
Yes.
And sells it that way too. And this is a hugely, Scott, you know, critical movie for me. You know, Scott and I grew up a little before a home video hit. You know, we were still young before that. For me, it was about third, fourth grade or something before someone I knew got a VCR and I started being able to rent stuff. And before that, all I had was my grade school library had the Crestwood House books, right?
Yeah.
That told the story of these stories. And I remember reading those and being obsessed with those. And the librarian was like, "Will you stop reading these, please?" and I was like, no. And then I remember literally like probably second or third film I rented, I was visiting my brother in Ohio and he would go to work and stuff. And I was just staying there during the day and he let me go rent some movies. And I saw they had a copy of The Wolfman and I rented The Wolfman and wow, like finally being able to see that in like fourth grade or so was a big deal for me.
That's great.
And I don't think I really, without that influence, this is one of the things I say, like, I don't think I would be doing what I do for a living, making, you know, movies and stuff. If it wasn't for this movie combines, you know, the horror thing, which is very near and dear to me, but it's also, there's movie magic here. You know, it's special effects and it's like great set design and stuff. And the things that exist outside normality, they didn't just start running a camera. They crafted every bit of this film. And I think it's again, why it has such an influence on me and why it's got such a long, you know, shadow in film history.
Oh, wonderfully said. Cannot add one thing to that. Thanks. Absolutely. So this has been a ton of fun. Again, one of my, you know, I don't know if it's my favorite, but definitely number two or three behind Ride. Yeah. So such a great film.
Legendary film.
Oh my God.
Awesome, man.
Yeah. I'm sure everyone listening has probably seen this. If you have not seen it, oh my God, we can't say enough. Acting.
Just stop what you're doing and watch it. What are you doing?
Absolutely. If you're
a
budding actor or anything, you want to be a director someday. You want to be a, you know, score a movie,
writer or
everything. The music is fantastic. Yeah. Just everything. You got to see this film. This is one of the best of all time. And so happy we to come out of the gate and, you know, really hit a home run, I should say, with a great, great film.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Cool.
All right, man. That was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for joining us. And thank you all for joining the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode, but the fun does not stop here. You can follow and interact with the show's hosts and listeners online on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Borgo Pass Horror Podcast is a presentation of Shadow Camera Film and Entertainment. This episode was edited by Livio Marino. The music was composed by Sean Poole. Opening and closing narration are by me, Kat Ahrens. Show titles and graphics created by Jim Towns. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast.